The Committee to Protect Journalists reports at least 12 journalists have been killed. More are missing and injured. We're joined now by CPJ's Middle East and North Africa program coordinator, Sharif Mansour. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Sharif. In these last few minutes we have, we've heard the story of ISIM. Tell us what you understand about what's happened to journalists. He was on the Israel-Lebanon border. Israel says they're looking into it. What's happening in Gaza?
Well, this is the deadliest time for journalists in Gaza. That is, according to our count, one of the highest toll for journalists covering the conflict since 1992. Since 2001, we've recently published stories of 20 Palestinian journalists who have been killed over the years, covering IDF operations. Many of them, 13, were in Gaza before the start of this war. But right now, we're looking at least 10 Palestinian journalists, mostly freelance photojournalists, who are taking outsized challenge and risk in order to tell the story of what's happening. But there are, in addition to Isam from Lebanon, at least one or two journalists from Israel who've been killed and went missing since the beginning of the raid on October 7. We're also still investigating a lot of damages to media facilities in Gaza that were bombed over the course of the week, reportedly at least 48 or so. Many were injured, many lost their homes, and many cannot access the outside world because of lack of internet.
So let me ask you, what are the international laws and conventions in place to safeguard journalists and hold those responsible for their killings?
Well, we call on Israel to immediately investigate what happened to Isam and his six colleagues who were injured. We support the Lebanon complaint in the UN to make an investigation. And we also call on Brazil, who is residing right now on this week on the UN Security Council, to make sure that journalist safety is included in any talks that's happening diplomatically.
And let me ask you, last week, BBC Arabic journalists Mohamed Tatunji and Haitham Abu Diab were reportedly stopped, assaulted, and held at gunpoint by Israeli police in Tel Aviv. What do you know about this situation?
Unfortunately, censorship is widespread, not just covering Gaza in Israel. And we've seen and reported a lot of journalists being threatened live, including from an Arabic TV just a couple of days ago. And journalists have told us they have received threats, in addition to all the misinformation that has been, spread to justify those attacks against journalists. And we saw the Israeli government right now making decrees to censor and close Palestinian media outlets and inciting against even Israeli journalists who would, quote unquote, harm national morale during the war.
And I wanted to ask, on Friday, the U.S. news organization Semaphore reported, quote, MSNBC has quietly taken three of its Muslim broadcasters out of the anchor's chair since Hamas's attack on Israel last Saturday amidst America's wave of sympathy for Israeli terror victims. The article detailed how Mehdi Hassan, Ayman Mualdin, and Ali Velshi have all seen their roles reduced over the past week, even though the three have some of the deepest knowledge of the region at the network, Semaphore reported. Your final comments on this?
Well, journalists must provide accurate, independent account of what's happening, including in time of crisis. We rely on them so that the misinformation that we see does not fuel the conflict. We rely on them so that we know the motivation and the implication of all the warring parties. And we rely on them to expose any potential for human rights violation or war crimes. So we call for the absolute resilience of journalists and the support of their editors so that they can do their job fairly without censorship.
Sharif Mansour, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Juan Gonzalez and Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once-over.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the very real possibility of losing our Constitution, and a new one will be substituted, which takes away our precious rights.
And our guest, David Arniak, will tell us just how close we are to that becoming a reality. And we'll also talk with constitutional scholar Steve Rohde about two highly important Supreme Court cases about to be heard.
One's on censorship of the Internet, and the other is on an alliance between the right and the left on taking away the rights of unhoused people.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. Our current U.S. Constitution was written in Philadelphia in 1787, but relatively soon it could be replaced by a new constitution, a new and very draconian constitution bearing little resemblance to the original. And so we are in imminent danger of the curtailment of the federal government's ability to protect the environment, protect consumer rights, civil rights, and that would bar the Congress from delegating rulemaking authority to federal agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, and that could place a cap on federal spending that would trigger massive cuts to domestic programs. Yes, right-wing billionaires like Charles Koch, a fossil fuel industry giant, and right-wing foundations, think tanks, and organizations have been steadily organizing at the state legislative level to call for this new constitutional convention. If this happens, such a convention would allow an unelected, unaccountable group of delegates free rein to rewrite our Constitution, imposing an extreme right-wing agenda on the entire nation. And these growing right-wing forces are only six states shy at this point from reaching their goal. So today we speak with David Arniak at the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. David Arniak is the research director at the CMD. David Arniak, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
David, what's at stake here? If the right wing gets a new constitutional convention and a new constitution, what could we lose? What would the USA look like if their measures are passed? Please talk about how they could get a majority of states to rescind any act of Congress or curtail the federal government's ability to protect the environment, consumers, and civil rights, and bar Congress from delegating rulemaking to federal agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and place a cap on federal spending that would trigger massive cuts. Can you talk about what's at stake here, please?
Sure. Really, everything is at stake, and I'll tell you why. There are no guardrails, constitutional scholars tell us, if an Article V constitutional convention is held. We've only had the one, which resulted in our current constitution. So once delegates are in place and they meet, really any amendment or any proposal to writing the constitution could be put forth and voted on. That could include all types of things. If you look at the makeup of the state legislatures across the country, they are overwhelmingly Republican dominated. So we will see things that Republicans and their corporate and billionaire backers support, getting rid of the EPA, right, the Environmental Protection Agency, getting rid of the Department of Education, amendments like, you know, allowing the states to choose which Supreme Court decisions to follow or not. moving the control of federal lands, you know, from the federal government back to the states. Like you talked about rulemaking, right? Delegating rulemaking to agencies. They could propose to get this out. There could be amendments, like we've seen, to limit the Supreme Court at 9 justices. We could see that change too. They could limit it further. So really, anything that you can imagine that are the issues of the day, getting rid of abortion, limiting voting rights, giving corporations, free speech, could be, set in stone in the U.S. Constitution.
You've made it pretty clear what the dangers are here, but just to make sure that our audience fully appreciates this, when you speak about a convention overturning the current Constitution, we're talking about the amendments to the current Constitution as well, are we not? The Bill of Rights and so forth. So talk to us a little bit about that as well. And then I suppose the first question to follow up on your explanation about what this might mean is, who's behind all of this? I mean, we know because we've heard that groups like the American Legislative Exchange Committee, and talk to us a bit about that, big oil giant corporations, I suspect, perhaps billionaires like Charles Koch. You tell us, who are the forces that have organized to make this a reality and to, in essence, give the minority right-wing, far, far conservative groups in our country control over governance in the United States?
To answer your question, it's a big coalition that is behind this, with both dark money that we've been able to trace. And dark money means simply that money that's been laundered in a way, whether it be through a donor advised fund or some other anonymous type of vehicle. But the American Legislative Exchange Council, or more commonly known as ALEC, a pay-to-play group that brings together state lawmakers and corporate lobbyists and right-wing operatives a few times a year to draft and vote on model bills as equals, has played a leading role. They've held a number of what they call Academy of the State training, where they've brought together state lawmakers and the operatives calling for this type of convention to talk about how the rules might go. They're trying to claim that there's a way to structure it so that it doesn't become what is termed a runaway convention or a situation where the Constitution is open to a radical rewrite. So they've put forth model legislation to try to do that. They're very focused on putting forth a balanced budget amendment. So there are some groups that are involved in this effort that are very focused on that. That means the federal government would be required every year to balance its budget, right? Which is, would be put the government in crisis. It's not like a household. They like to kind of consider it that way and present it that way to folks. The federal government should balance their budget like a household, but the federal government doesn't operate like a household. It's a massive organization, and if they were forced to do that, many of the services that are provided to folks would be put in jeopardy. The other group that's really important in this and has the most money is a group called Convention of States, and that's led by Mark Meckler. He's a Koch operative. He lives in Texas. He was very, very much involved in the COVID disinformation or misinformation campaign. Some of his money is known. He's received money from the Mercer family. He has deep ties to operatives like Eric O'Keefe. Also a Koch network folk who runs a number of different groups. It's really a large coalition. We know that they are also actively looking to form alliances with Republican Attorney General. And why? Because they think they already have enough resolutions to hold a constitutional convention. So they're trying to force Congress to let this happen. And in order to force it, they need what's called a mandamus action. And they're looking for a Republican Attorney General to move that. So, yeah, very broad working group trying to move this forward. And what was your first question again? I'm sorry, I didn't answer your first question.
No, I think you've answered the question of who the groups are behind it. And an amazing array of essentially right-wing groups. And I think you've made that very clear. Thank you.
David, how does this all work? Please talk about Article 5 of the Constitution that allows for a new constitutional convention. What's happening?
Yeah, so it's a kind of little known provision. Like, so far, Congress has, put forth amendments, and then that's brought back, to the states. And if they get, three-fourths of state legislatures to ratify, then, we get an amendment to the Constitution. So the Constitution also allows for another way where, it's two-thirds of the states can call, for a convention using one type of resolution. Or some legal scholars have interpreted this more liberally, that they could, it doesn't have to be narrowed on one issue and can be, all different types of issues and combine. That's the kind of right-wing logic that's moving forward at the moment. You get 34 states, then you can have your constitutional convention. The states would pick delegates, the right-wing saying that each state would get one delegate or two, possibly, from what we've seen through our research. Obviously, this would be a major problem because the states differ in terms of population, right? So a state like Wyoming would get the same number of delegates as a state like California or Texas. So the populations of these states are totally different, but they'd have equal say and equal votes if a constitutional convention was held. Then they would, in the convention, depending on the rules and how people act, which again, there's not much in the Constitution that says how a convention has to be held, but they have to get to a place where they vote. And if they vote on amendments that come out, then those would go back to the states to be ratified. And you need 38 states to ratify for that amendment to go to the Constitution. But they could, according to some constitutional scholars, decide to just scrap the Constitution in whole, vote on a whole new Constitution. Obviously, the worst case scenario.
David, this is amazing when you listen to you talk about where this is at, how many states they already have on record as calling for this constitution, new constitutional convention. I'm wondering a couple of things. Number one, I'm curious as to why we don't hear about this more in the press. I'm glad we're covering it here today on our show, but why in the general media don't you hear about this? This is profound. I mean, it goes beyond even something as historically noteworthy as the first time that a Speaker of the House has been thrown out of the speakership. I mean, this is as big as it gets with respect to governance in the United States. It seems to have been done almost rather quietly in a certain way. And yet, how quiet could it have been when you have as many states as have already called for the conventions? How should we understand that? And what do you attribute that to? And I guess, does it have something to do with how well-organized these right-wing groups are that are pressing for this constitutional convention? Have they gone out of their way to try to keep it under the radar as they quietly work for this convention to become a reality? Talk to us a bit about that.
I think you brought up an excellent question and something that those of us that are working to expose this effort and get reporters to pay attention have been wondering for some time. I really don't think that they're trying to keep it all that secret. I mean, their activities are online. These resolutions are moving in the state houses. So anybody that's tracking legislation would be able to see, as these things are voted on or moved, by lawmakers. And recently, Jody Herrington in the House introduced a bill to call for it, a convention saying that the states have already put forth enough resolutions using what we call the wacky math theory, which is combining all these different resolutions on different issues over an unlimited time period. Some Republicans are already proposing that they have enough. So what does that mean? If the House, has a bill, all they're really looking for is the Senate. Now, we don't know what the House leadership thinks. Actually, we don't know if there is House leadership. I guess we're waiting to see that, who emerges. But say the Republicans split the Senate in 2024, and then in both the House, if we have Republican leadership that believes what these groups are calling for, and that they actually have the numbers, we could see a constitutional convention next year. And in fact, we've seen communications that they're preparing for that to happen. Yeah, it's really mind-bending to try to think about or try to wonder why, mainstream media is not paying attention to this issue, because it really is the greatest threat to our democracy.
Yeah, I'll say their slogan is burn the whole thing down. We're speaking with David Armiak from the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Michael Smith.
I'm with my former law partner, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're talking probably the most crucial question facing us, and the scary thing is that people don't really know about it. David, talk about, please, the intent on infringing on the right of the government to regulate, particularly climate change, and how this could tie the hands of people trying to reverse the direction that the fossil fuel companies and their allies are taking.
With, in particular, many of these right-wing operatives involved in this, CONCON effort or the Constitutional Convention effort, do not respect the federal government or what it does. Some of the groups may be receiving fossil fuel money or money from billionaires who received, made their profits from the fossil fuel industry. We could see, the destruction or the dismantling of the Environmental Protection Agency. We could see the removal of the federal government in management of federal land. So our national park system or our national monuments or our national forests, so all of this could be returned to the state, let them to decide what to do. So it could be a free-for-all for fossil fuel development if the states, gain control of these lands. So it would make climate action, much more difficult. You may have seen, over the last year or so, debates around environmental social government factors in investment decisions or managing public pensions and whatnot. This has become, something of a hot button issue on the right, under the broad umbrella of attacking so-called woke capitalism. So we could see, something in the Constitution, if it was to be written, that forces, investors to treat all corporations equal. Because they've already put forth bills in the states that prevent discrimination against fossil fuel companies in exchange for state contracts or state investments.
David, too, that I'm listening to you. Of course, I've done some research on this, as has Mike before the show. I hope our audience understands just how profound this is. I mean, we're not only talking about issues of climate change. There's not much more important than that, of course, in terms of the survival of the planet and ourselves. But we really are talking about a new kind of governance where there would be no guarantee of free speech as we know it today. There would be perhaps even less democracy than there is today under the current Constitution, which has its own democratic rights limitations, certainly. Certainly, that's the desire of the right-wing forces that are behind this. The rights of defendants in criminal cases, and on it goes. You've made it clear that they're not miles away from achieving success. In fact, they think they're in the brink of success and are trying to push ahead with that idea. There's really nothing much left to do except to call this convention. That I realize there's great legal argument about still. What are the groups? There must be groups besides your own, of course, that are fighting against this effort of obtaining this new right-wing constitutional convention. Who are they? Who are their allies? And what kind of a fight are they putting up? And how would you assess how this is perhaps going to go in the near future?
To answer your question, I mean, there's groups both on the right and the left and in the middle that are, deeply concerned about this CONCON effort. Most prominently, the group Common Cause, which has, worked in the states to lobby against these resolutions as they pop up. And it's been difficult. Last month, the governor in California, Gavin Newsom, introduced a resolution in California to call for a constitutional convention to address the public health crisis around gun violence. Common Cause, tried to convince, Democrats there. It's a Democrat majority state. They got a trifecta that this was a bad idea because there was no way they were going to get, 38 states to ratify this amendment, right? But still, they didn't listen. They chose, to go ahead and pass this resolution. So now, this resolution could be used, by the right as another state calling for a convention. And the other concern is that this could move in other blue states looking to address the gun crisis. But again, given the makeup of the state legislatures across the country, you don't have 38 Dem majority states. So the chances of getting an amendment to address the public health crisis around gun violence passed, you know, and enshrined in our Constitution is very slim. But the chance of something like a balanced budget amendment, which they say, you know, they already have 28 states with resolutions passed, you know, to get them to 34 and then possibly 38, isn't that impossible, right? So,
David, if I may, what you're saying is that there's, although there's some legal controversy over it, the fact is that there's a good argument that the right wing can make that if you've called for a convention to take up one or particularly two issues, there's no way necessarily to constrain that from going through and creating a whole new constitution going beyond what the initial resolution may have called for, in the example of California calling for a resolution on gun control, correct? That there's no limiting necessarily, yes.
Yeah, there's no guardrails. You know, constitutional scholars like David Super at Georgetown in particular have been very outspoken about this and have provided, you know, very detailed analysis and legal arguments to show that, in fact, there is no guardrails, and chances of a runaway convention are very high. In particular, in this extreme environment, divisive environment, folks would not listen to, you know, the minority, you know, if they got to the convention.
In terms of my question of a minute or so ago, too, and I realize we've been throwing them at you here willy-nilly, perhaps, but I get the impression so far that while the right wing is well organized in this regard, and indeed have made considerable progress, some of them think enough, the more progressive forces, the liberal forces in the country, do not seem to be as well organized or as together in how they're approaching it. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that a lot of lawmakers are caught off guard, you know, when these resolutions are brought up. They're not really aware of what's going on. They don't know, you know, who's behind it. Certainly, you know, the Republican members of ALEC, who are often, you know, carrying forth these resolutions in the states, they're well aware because they've gone to trainings, they've heard about it at, you know, every ALEC meeting, or they've had the opportunity to. So it's something that they're well aware of. I think, you know, when you go to public hearings, you often see mostly supporters for the resolutions and not much in the way of opposition. But I should say that it's not like all right-wing groups are not united around this. Certainly in some states where these resolutions have been passed, Republicans have voted against them. Groups like the John Birch Society have come out against the resolution. So some groups on the right and individuals on the right that are just as concerned as folks in the center or folks on the left about where this might go.
You know, David, a while ago we spoke with Professor Nancy McLean, who wrote the great book Democracy in Chains, and she maintains and demonstrates that this campaign to roll back democracy has been going on stealthily for maybe four decades, and they've really picked up speed. And that's what concerns me. How many people are involved? Where are they headquartered? Who are we talking about here?
Oh, geez. I mean, there are so many groups, you know, that are involved, right? But so I don't really know where to start or how to answer that question succinctly. But, you know, certainly ALEC, you know, is very important. We talked about them. The State Policy Network, which is a network of right-wing think tanks that are usually, like, called upon to provide academic legitimacy for horrible policy ideas in the states. And they are also, you know, members of ALEC or members of ALEC participate in their network. Republican Attorneys General Association is another group. I mentioned them before. The Heritage Foundation and its 501c4, Heritage Action, the Koch Network of Groups from Stand Together to Americans for Prosperity, their AstroTurf group. So, I mean, it's a long list of groups. But when you look at these groups and you analyze their funding, most of them are registered as nonprofits, except for, you know, the overt political ones like the Republican Attorneys General Association. But the vast majority of them, you know, get their funding from a handful of foundations, you know, run by, you know, the Koch, Charles Koch, but also folks like the Bradley Foundation or Sealy Freedom Trust or Sarah Skaif or Diane Davis Spencer Foundation. There's a number of them that are providing, you know, much larger grants than most grantors.
Well, we have surely appreciated this, and I hope it alerts a lot of more people than have been alerted, frankly, to what is going on. How can people get involved in this effort, one way or the other, frankly? But particularly if they certainly want to fight this rather dangerous and loose cannon approach, how do they get involved? How do they get involved with your organization, the CMD, and so forth?
Yeah, I would support organizations like the Center for Media and Democracy and their investigative reporting and research around this. Groups like Common Cause, which are in the states and lobbying against these resolutions as they are voted on and introduced. The American Constitutional Society, Russ Feingold wrote a great book on this issue. And he's doing a book tour, so go see him as he comes to your state and support them. But most importantly, there is an effort to rescind resolutions, old resolutions that are on the books. So, you know, states like New York, you know, deeply blue state, that, you know, there's an effort to rescind an Article V call that's been on the books there for a long time. And there's some other, you know, states as well. So if you see, you know, reports of this in your local Capitol paper, go out there and support the rescission effort. Talk to your lawmakers. Tell them why this is so important.
Well, David Arniak from the Center for Media and Democracy, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. This is certainly an alarming development, and we're glad to have you elaborate on what's going on, and we'd like to have you back. So thank you again for being on our show.
Thank you so much, David.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a really important issue.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Today we look at two issues coming before the Supreme Court in its just open 2023-24 term. First, we'll discuss two cases whose outcome will determine the future of free speech online when it considers the constitutionality of laws passed in Florida and Texas that, if allowed to stand, will severely restrict social media companies from removing certain political posts or social media accounts. And then we'll take up the matter of whether or not the court agrees to hear a case where California's Governor Newsom and officials from other states asked the Supreme Court to overrule Martin versus Boise. That's a federal appeals court case coming from the Ninth Circuit that protected the rights of the unhoused to sleep outside on public property if there are no adequate alternatives available. Our guest for this topic is our go-to constitutional scholar, Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a noted constitutional scholar and activist. He is the past chair of the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation of Southern California, the founder and current chair of
Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, the author of American Words of Freedom and the book Freedom of Assembly. Steve Rohde is also a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books, to Truthdig, and he is a leader in the national campaign to free imprisoned investigative journalist Julian Assange. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be with both of you.
Well, Steve, let's first examine two cases that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. Both cases examining the limits of free speech. One is Moody v. Net Choice, the other is Net Choice v. Paxton, particularly free speech online. One has to do with a Texas law, the other a Florida law, and both of these laws have to do with whether the laws restrict social media companies from removing certain political posts or social media accounts, whether they're constitutional or not. What do those laws say that have caused the media companies to challenge their constitutionality and question the question of whether or not they are unconstitutional by way of a too deep a limit, if you will, on free speech online?
Well, these are two very important cases. One commentator said these may be the most important free speech cases in recent court history. Back in 2021, the Republican legislatures in Texas and Florida passed, and the Republican governors of those states signed, two new laws with elaborate restrictions on social media. Now, there's no mistake about the political motivation behind these laws. They accused liberal social media sites of censoring conservatives. In fact, Trump was removed from Twitter and Facebook. But Ron DeSantis openly said that if big tech censors enforce rules inconsistently to discriminate in favor of the dominant Silicon Valley ideology, they will now be held accountable. But the problem is that when government steps in these state governments, then you have a serious question of censorship under the First Amendment. So these two new laws in each state were enjoined by federal district courts. But then the pathways parted so that the Florida court injunction was upheld by the appellate court, but the Texas injunction was overturned by the appellate court in Texas. Ironically, the Supreme Court stepped in, and we'll talk about this later, to keep the injunction in place. So courts have already ruled that these statutes are unconstitutional. What's involved here are three types of regulations that these states have imposed upon social media. And of course, we're talking about YouTube and Facebook and X, formerly known as Twitter. The three areas are content moderation, forcing the companies and punishing them if they follow their community standards and remove certain posts which they find objectionable. Secondly, are individualized explanations. The laws require every decision to be explained online, and finally, general disclosure provision. So the cases work their way up through the courts. And what the courts are finding, and in my view, what I hope the Supreme Court will find, is that these are private entities. We think of social media as so widespread and pervasive, but they are private publishers, in a sense. And in these areas, what they do is aggregate content. They accumulate different messages from different parties, and they moderate the content according to their rules, which every subscriber has consented to. And the courts have found and held that that's exactly what the First Amendment protects. The presentation of an edited compilation of speech generated by others is protected by the First Amendment. The fact that the content may be created by others doesn't change the First Amendment analysis, so that these content moderation restrictions, which would punish sites for doing this, violate the First Amendment. In the area of the second category of individualized explanations, this was clearly a way to punish social media because every single decision, and there are billions of messages passing over social media every day, to require thousands, tens of thousands of moderators to explain each decision rather than to simply apply the general standards would have a chilling effect on making those decisions. So the courts have ruled, but because there was a conflict between the two circuits, it now has reached the United States Supreme Court.
Do you believe there should be a distinction between what, say, the New York Times can publish in print and what, say, Facebook can publish online?
There are definitely differences between newspapers and social media. Much of newspapers is produced, the content is produced by employees of that newspaper, except perhaps op-eds or letters to the editor. But from a First Amendment standpoint, these are private entities exercising their own editorial judgment. We may agree or disagree. We may think they're too conservative or too progressive. But the challenge is when government steps in an effort to dictate what that content will be. That's when the specter of censorship arises, and it's as much a threat to social media sites as it is to the New York Times or a book publisher.
Steve, I wonder, you talked earlier in your answer to a question about how significant these cases are seen by people who follow the court and follow the issues of the First Amendment. Is it not, in fact, the case that how these justices rule could have, will have, I would think, significant implications for, well, the future of what's left of our democracy and elections, since voters increasingly rely on social media to read and discuss and form their political views, do they not?
I do think the case will have serious implications. Now, I don't want to present a rosy picture here. I think we know that a lot of misinformation and disinformation makes its way onto social media sites. I think the three of us grew up with the adage that we should not believe everything we read in the newspaper, and I certainly think we should not believe everything we read on social media. And I think we should teach everyone, including young people, to be far more critical thinkers and skeptical when it comes to information online. In fact, in preparation for today's program, I looked up a study by Pew Research in January of 2021, and it was surprising about whether people rely on social media for their news. The study found that while 96% of people look to more than one source for their news, 35% get their news from television, 26% from news websites and apps, and only 11% from social media. So I think we should have some hope that people are reaching diverse sources for their information, and I think the Texas law and the Florida law are attempts to manipulate those sources, and I'm hopeful the court will strike them down.
Does the fact that last spring, in a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court prevented the Texas law from taking effect while the litigation continues tell us anything about the way the justices will now ultimately decide the case? It's worth noting that among the four dissenters was not only conservative Justice Samuel Alito, but also liberal justices.
Yes, that was peculiar. So that's what I mentioned earlier, that when the Texas law was enjoined, but the appellate court reversed that, the Supreme Court did step in and kept the injunction in place, which is a pro-First Amendment position. But four justices, and you've mentioned most of them, Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch, but they were joined by liberal Elena Kagan. They all thought the law should be allowed to go into effect pending the litigation. It's always dangerous to read the tea leaves. I think Elena Kagan may be persuaded by the briefing and the arguments that are going to be made. My prediction is this will be at least a 5-4 decision on the First Amendment side of the case, striking down that Texas and Florida laws.
Well, this is, of course, a Law and Disorder radio that you're listening to. I'm Jim Lafferty, and along with my co-host Michael Smith, are interviewing at the moment Steve Rohde, a constitutional scholar, on some important matters before the Supreme Court. I wonder, Steve, your last thoughts on the importance of this case. I was interested in hearing you just say you're somewhat optimistic that the decision will be a pro-free speech decision. I wonder why you feel that way, given the overall highly conservative nature of the court these days.
Well, the court is conservative, and all of us, the three of us, and in other contexts, I've been very critical of this court. They do have one area in terms of free speech that they have ruled in ways that, in my view, protect and defend the First Amendment. And that's the strain of rulings and thinking that I think will prevail in this case. There were some cases last term which showed signs of that, and I'm hopeful that that's what the court will tap into in these two cases.
Okay, Steve, let's now take a look, albeit briefer, of the effort by liberal government officials like California's Governor Newsom, joining with more conservative officials from other states within the jurisdiction of the Ninth Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, challenging that court's ruling in Martin versus Boise, where the court ruled that unhoused persons can't be punished for sleeping outside on public property if there are no adequate alternatives available. Newsom and the others are taking this action because they want cities to have the right to remove troublesome homeless tent encampments from their streets. Talk to us about this case, please.
To put this in context, 5 years ago, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit did rule that Boise, Idaho could not criminally punish the unhoused for sleeping in encampments and other public property unless the city had provided adequate housing. This was a strong, sensible ruling, and it has lasted for 5 years. Even the Supreme Court at that time did not take up that ruling. They let the Boise ruling stand. And municipalities and counties have known that they are on notice that they must provide adequate housing and they cannot punish the victims of homelessness. Well, now a new case is coming along from Grants Pass, Oregon, where instead of a criminal punishment for sleeping outdoors and in encampments, they imposed a civil fine. Now, it's not much of a difference, but it's been enough to reach the doors of the Supreme Court. And they are trying to re-argue and overturn the Boise case. And what you've alluded to is the troublesome fact that in doing so, which is largely from a Republican and conservative a homelessness standpoint, they're gaining the support of people like Governor Gavin Newsom. This is very troubling because I think Newsom is joining with other mayors and governors that are just frustrated by their inability to deal with the question of affordable housing and the unhoused. So we get Governor Newsom trotting out exclamations that the courts have distorted Boise, and he says it's simply gone too far, and he complains that people's lives are at risk what is happening on the streets and sidewalks is unacceptable. Well, it's unacceptable because of what our society and what our leaders have failed to do. And to make the answer the reversal of Boise. So this is coming before the court at a time asking the court to reverse Boise. I know both of you have strong views on this, and for me, at least in the city of Los Angeles with our relatively new mayor, Karen Bass, on her first day declared an emergency state of the city because of the problem of homelessness. We've allocated money for this problem, but there hasn't been the political will, and for Governor Newsom to join with conservatives, that will be unacceptable, and he should be reminded by his own statement that people's lives are at risk.
The press indeed itself has also made much of the fact that this legal action was taken in this case to give more freedom to the government to remove unhoused tent encampments from the streets, as you say, brought by liberals and conservatives joining together. And I wonder, and I'd like your comment on it, it seems to me then that this is an example of how, when in our capitalist nation, push can come to shove when the profits of cities, depending on tourism, say, for their money, and they feel the tent encampments encroach on that, or when they fear the profits of cities' big business enterprises are going to be threatened by these encampments, that then, of course, profits will always trump human rights. And so the conservatives and the liberals, both capitalists, trump human rights always. They say profits trumps that. Your thoughts on that?
No, I think you're making a good point, Jim. I think this is an abdication of the kind of liberal and progressive principles that a Governor Newsom and others claim to stand on. It's really a failure on their part. I mean, on the Boise case, they've had 5 years knowing that they must provide adequate, sustainable housing for the unhoused, leading to affordable housing that people can afford once they find work. Unless mental incapacity is the most serious obstacle. And instead, to seek to overturn a very favorable ruling elevates the desire for these cities to be pretty and attractive to tourists and the rest. Housing is a huge issue, but the answer is not to jail the unhoused and to punish them civilly. It is to provide the kind of safe, affordable, sustained housing they need.
Does this not also bring to mind the duplicity, if you will, in a nation like ours? I'm thinking of freedom of the press and Julian Assange. Biden can preach and talk all the time about freedom of the press. It's a cornerstone of American democracy, and we need to protect it all around the world. At the same time, he's prosecuting Julian Assange for the quote-unquote crime of exposing U.S. war crimes in the Middle East. Isn't that rather another example, if you will, of certain principles only being willing to be abided by our government when it suits their purpose?
Well, you've brought us full circle. And in the context of the cases we discussed at the beginning of this program, the fact that the Biden administration filed an amicus brief in the Texas and Florida cases saying that the presentation of an edited compilation of speech generated by others is protected by the First Amendment. That is the principle behind WikiLeaks, which Julian Assange established and is now in jail over. And the Biden administration, picked up from the Trump administration, is pursuing his extradition, knowing that the kind of organizing, compilation, and publishing of information is exactly what's protected by the First Amendment. This is an egregious example of the hypocrisy of the Biden administration, and I have not seen this recognized and commented on in the corporate media at all.
Fear, we are now about out of time, Steve Rohde, and I wonder, you have so many wonderful writings online and elsewhere. Remind our listeners where we can find those writings to keep following your thinking and your analysis in this area.
Well, you're very kind. I'm proud to write for the Los Angeles Review of Books, also for Truth Dig and the LA Progressive. All of those can be found online, and you can simply Google Steven Rohde. I do exercise my own free speech, and one way I do it is joining the two of you as often as possible on this extraordinary radio show of which I'm so proud to be a part.
Well, and we're thrilled to have you with us, believe me, my friend. Steve Rohde, thank you again for joining us today again on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You talked about Mohamed Bazoum of Niger. Mohamed Bazoum comes from a socialist party, but they have not been socialists for decades. They are basically caretakers for the United States, the French, and so on. US has the largest drone base in the world in Agadez, Niger. These guys have become caretakers for the imperialist bloc.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on Africa, from neoliberalism to independence. Almost every country in Africa was colonized by Europe. Today, while nominally sovereign, many of these countries are in the clutches of the big international banks. The old colonial masters, Britain and France, still have a foothold in Africa. But the U.S. has been pushing them aside, moving in to capture resources and markets. Washington has established an Africa command, deployed troops, and built a string of bases. But France won't let go of its grip on its former colonies. The coup in Niger, a former French colony, is not your run-of-the-mill coup. It must be understood in the context of widespread discontent with ruling elites and their collaboration with imperialism. Genuine independence is still far off for Niger and other countries in the Sahel region of West and Central Africa. To talk about these issues is Vijay Prashad. He's an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the director of Tricontinental and chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. I interviewed Vijay Prashad in mid-August. He was at his home in Santiago, Chile. Welcome back to the program.
So, salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. There are coups and there are coups. The one in Niger, ousting the elected government of Mohamed Bazoum, on July 26, you say is different. How so? You make a distinction then between generals' coups and colonels' coups. Explain what you mean.
Well, look, we know that coups have a certain patina, a certain understanding in the consciousness. For instance, if you go back in the history of the modern world since 1945, there have been a series of important coup d'etats. Let's take a part of the world I know very well. Take Pakistan. Pakistan wins its independence in 1947. you know, so decent liberal government, Liaquat Ali Khan leading the government. When the left started to make its noises, and that too not in a very loud way, the military entered. There was a coup d'etat almost immediately. Now, Pakistan punctually seen generals' coups. Not only are these coups led by generals, you know, General Ayub Khan, General Yahya Khan, General Zia-ul-Haq,